Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
9/11 lifted the veil on a threat that is far broader and more dangerous than we saw that morning. An enemy that was not sated by the destruction inflicted that day and is determined to strike again. To answer this threat and to protect our people, we need more than retaliation. We need more than a reaction to the last attack. We need to do everything in our power to stop the next attack. And so America has gone on the offense across the world.
Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, the president's new plan to try detainees came under fire from the Pentagon's top uniformed lawyers. They said that potentially restricting a defendant's access to evidence could violate treaty obligations. Well, many Supreme Court reporters are parsing over the president's plan, and they include Jess Braven, Supreme Court reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Jess, I was hoping you could help us do the same. Welcome.
Oh, hi.
And briefly, what is the plan? Because at first yesterday, the president appeared to be making concessions to critics by acknowledging the existence of secret CIA prisons abroad. But it seems that he hasn't altered his original goal of having military tribunals with the ability to withhold evidence against the accused if that evidence is classified. Have we got that right?
That's right. And I think that in looking at what the president said yesterday, you have to separate the, I guess you'd say, the operational decision to move these 14 prisoners from CIA facilities to Guantanamo Bay and the structural decision regarding what future trials will look like. In June, the Supreme Court ruled that the president had exceeded his authority when he sought to establish a freestanding military trial system that really was wholly a creature of the executive branch, and that congressional authority in order to make one.
I'm sorry, would you just repeat that last sentence? We had some interference there.
Sorry. I was just saying that in June, the Supreme Court said that exceeded his authority when he sought to set up a military trial system as a product of the executive branch. And essentially, if he wanted any kinds of trials for these prisoners outside the existing rules of the Uniform Code of Military Justice or the civilian trial system, he'd need congressional authority. So what he laid out yesterday was his idea of what Congress should authorize him to do.
And, of course, the political aspect of this is that many analysts say that how could Congress refuse in the run-up to the midterm elections? But putting the politics aside, the president also is not ending the secret prisons program, is asking Congress to approve that. Is the administration on solid legal ground with that program?
Well, there are a lot of legal questions that arise. If you're talking about prisons that exist in foreign countries, there's the issue of American law, and then there's also the issue of the laws of those countries themselves. And we've heard a lot of European officials question whether it's appropriate to have such facilities within their borders. Of course, the president did not say where the facilities are located. However, he did say that there are no more prisoners being held at this time by the CIA in those facilities. Now, perhaps there is some other agency that wasn't disclosed that is holding prisoners, but certainly the White House gave us the impression that it has, for now, cleared out the secret prison.
Well, briefly, Jess, the president's getting pushback from Republican senators such as John McCain and Lindsey Graham. They're pushing for more legal rights for these detainees in the military tribunals when they take place, and so are Pentagon lawyers. One said in an exchange today on the Hill that they think that if a trial gets all the way to the point where there is evidence that is classified and would reveal something, that instead of withholding that from the accused, the trial should be dropped. Of course, the Bush administration wants to go ahead and withhold the evidence. Where do you think that's going to go, briefly?
Well, I think that when you're having when the president says something needs to be done for military necessity, such as withholding evidence from the defendant, and then you have top military officials in uniform testifying that it's not necessary, I think it will be difficult to persuade a lot of lawmakers that it is, that that's the way to go. In other words, where does the president get this belief if his own military staff is saying it's not necessary?
Well, this debate will continue. Jess Braven, Supreme Court reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
And the president's speeches this week have been choreographed to run up to the fifth anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks. And all week, the president has posed the question that that anniversary is prompting, you know, are we safe? The president says, safer, but not yet safe. Well, Dr. Erwin Redlener poses a different question. He asks, are we ready? In his new book, Americans at Risk, Dr. Redlener outlines five nightmare scenarios of mega disasters, both man-made and natural, on American soil, and answers his own question with a resounding no, we're not ready. But he also outlines things that people and public officials can do. Well, we thought we'd invite him in to tell us more. Dr. Redlener is director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University, president of the Children's Health Fund. He founded that with singer Paul Simon, and he joins us from New York. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
And I want to tick through some of the laundry list you give of reasons why we're not ready. You know, start with Americans don't embrace the basic concept of prevention. It's just not something we think about. But what are some of the others that come to mind?
Well, in terms of getting the country ready, it really does take a partnership between what citizens need to do and what government's responsibilities are. And we find on both sides of that equation that the parties are just not, you know, both the public and the government are not really doing the kinds of things that we could do to make ourselves prepared. And by the way, I think the things that we need to do fall far short of getting obsessed with preparedness or worrying about terrorist threats. We're just talking about some prudent steps that every citizen could take to help make the country generally more ready for any kind of large-scale disaster, whether it's terrorism-related or natural disaster or pandemic, for that matter.
Well, so, and a lot of it seems to do with, you know, having an imagination about it, just thinking about it, thinking what would the situation be, what might it call for? And you say there's been a real failure of imagination.
Well, one of the tough things about large-scale disaster planning is that every time you get, it seems like you might get an idea, it is very important that we try to consider what the secondary and tertiary effects of that concept might be. For example, let's say we're planning for what we do in the event of a pandemic avian flu occurring, and somebody says, well, it'll be a good idea to close schools for 12 weeks so that we'll reduce the spread of the pandemic. Well, that's fine as an initial idea, but if you don't imagine the consequences of that, for example, who will watch the kids? What happens to the workforce? What about single parents who are responsible for their children, and how will they go to work? And on and on, the economic consequences need to get folded into the planning. We've not been very good at any of that.
Right. And a simple solution there or suggestion there is that employers now have to really plan on how their employees might work from home. But staying with kids, by the way, because you say they're especially vulnerable when there's a lack of planning, everything from considering a child-sized dose of avian flu vaccine to remembering to order cribs for infants in shelters. We don't tend to think of children.
Well, in spite of all the exhortations and reminders by pediatricians and parents, we find that children are frequently left out of planning. And this is really this has very detrimental potential consequences on the whole planning process, because if we forget to think about what people will do and how we'll protect our children in the event of a large-scale disaster, this can really throw a monkey wrench into the implementation of virtually everything else. For example, we might issue an evacuation order for a city that's experiencing a flooding or other potential catastrophic event. But what about the kids in school? Where are they going to go? How are they going to get reunited with their parents? People will need to know what the status is of the plans for their children before they do anything. And that goes without saying, but it still has not really quite sunk into the mindset of most of our disaster planning processes.
Well, you said, you know, public officials should be thinking about it and evacuations. But parents, I mean, it seems so simple, but should be thinking about designating someone near a school to get their child if they can't get there.
Well, if you think about parents at work, maybe commuting relatively far distances to their employment, and a disaster or something happens where they have to either remain in place or they have to be evacuated somewhere, and they can't get home really to pick up the kids and deal with the children in their neighborhoods, there must be plans in place for friends, relatives, and others who might be able to fill in the gap and deal with kids that are not able to be reunited with their parents right away.
Well, you lay out several stomach-churning scenarios. I want to touch on them over the next few minutes. Everything from earthquake and tsunami on the West Coast to avian flu outbreak in Manhattan. And one, you know, staying with children, most disturbing, a fictional attack on a school in Tucson, Arizona, by terrorists who have come across the border. You are very concerned about children being attacked by terrorists. I mean, people might say that's alarmist. Why are you thinking
well,
that way?
I understand why people say that. In fact, people in my own family say that. But here's the problem. In 2004, the relatively remote and obscure city of Beslan in Russia was attacked by Chechenian terrorists with presumed relationships with al-Qaeda, in fact. They killed over 150 children in the school, along with 150 or so adults. It was a vicious attack that was directed at children. And besides that history of terrorists not respecting the what might be civilized, limitations on attacking civilians and children, I think there's plenty of evidence, including written documentation by some senior al-Qaeda officials, that retribution against America would require the killing of 4 million Americans, and explicitly stating that 2 million of those victims should be children. So I think the notion that children may well be targeted by terrorists is unfortunately real, and I wanted to lay out the scenario, not to frighten people, but to try to make sure that our planning mm-hmm. is realistic and we understand the kind of adversities we might be facing.
Well, you say prevention is the key, and these are some big ideas like preventing, keeping the borders safe. But beyond that, you talk about response. And in this case, for instance, in the scenario you outline, it's just chaotic, hectic, unimaginable. Again, people hadn't thought about it. And tick off some of the things that you suggest schools should be thinking about to react to something like this. I'm thinking one person in charge, you know, so there's not layers of bureaucracy.
Yes, there are a number of basic things that would actually serve schools very well in the event of any kind of major emergency, from terrorism to a natural disaster or anything else, really. And that goes like this. So first of all, having somebody clearly in charge, having training exercises and drills with teachers and school officials about how you'd handle evacuations or other emergencies, making sure that the school has functioning relationships in advance of any disaster with other local first responder agencies, police, fire, EMS, the hospital system, and so forth. And it's also incumbent upon parents to make sure that the schools do this. And I think it's every parent's right or responsibility even to inquire with the school. It could be either you as an individual or through the parent-teacher organization to go to the school and say, we'd like to know what are, in fact, the disaster plans and what are you doing to mitigate the possibility that there might be some significant event here that would endanger our kids. That kind of pressure from parents will really help schools get their acts together, and I think it's very appropriate for any parent to think about that.
Talking to Dr. Erwin Redlener, an expert on disaster preparedness and also author of the new book, Americans at Risk, and also a pediatrician, his main concern, kids. Why, he asks, for instance, aren't more schools retrofitted in earthquake areas? Well, they can't afford it. When we come back, we'll talk to Dr. Redlener more about how to react to avian flu, what you can do at home, much more. From Dr. Erwin Redlener, coming up here and now. Where avian flu hits Manhattan. And you point out that, one of the things we don't think about, although we have talked about it a bit here on Here and Now, is the need for ventilators. 80,000 in use across the country, 105,000 sitting across the country. And that would be used like in a heartbeat in just New York alone.
Yeah, this issue with the mechanical ventilators that are breathing machines, basically, that would help people who are very, very sick in an avian flu, it's really very emblematic of the entire problem here, which is that we have a certain capacity that kind of more or less, and not always, but more or less gets us through to day-to-day needs in the healthcare system. The problem is if we're facing some very large public health catastrophe like a pandemic flu, almost everything that we're talking about, including the mechanical ventilators, would be in short supply within 24 to 36 hours. And what happens is that, you know, and by the way, there are 80,000 mechanical ventilators currently, but during the flu season, almost a little bit more than 100,000 may be already in use just during a regular flu, not even the avian flu. In an avian flu situation, the country might need 600 or 700,000, you know, five, six, seven times more than we actually have. And the problem is this is a recurrent one, is that the government keeps saying you need to be prepared to surge, to increase your capacity without providing the resources for hospitals, most of whom in the United States are living on the financial edge to begin with. So,
well, we just want to interrupt for a second because President Bush last year asked for $7.1 billion from Congress to help prepare for an avian flu outbreak. That would go towards early detection, containment, treatment. And his plan also calls for improving the process of creating flu vaccines, stockpiling antiviral drugs. So given that, tell us more about your concerns.
Well, here's the thing, that with that $7.1 billion, about 95% of it, in fact, is going for the development of new vaccines and antiviral medication like the Tamiflu that we've all heard about. Mm-hmm. And that's all fine, and that's money well spent, but it leaves only a piddling amount to allow the hospitals and the healthcare system to be able to gear up to become more robust in their ability to respond in the event of an actual pandemic. So what has gotten shortchanged in the president's formula has been the hospitals and the healthcare system. And this is really a major Achilles heel for us because, in fact, we'll end up having potentially a pandemic before we get that vaccine. And we'll have to depend on the hospital systems, which right now are being starved as far as emergency preparedness is concerned.
Well, this is one of your criticisms that over the past several decades, the entire healthcare system, every agency has been gutted pretty much. And now we're seeing some of that. And also hospitals, as you write, assume in some of their disaster plans that they're going to send overflow patients to neighboring hospitals. And, of course, we saw in New Orleans there were no neighboring hospitals.
No, and in fact, in a pandemic, the situation would be even worse. I mean, you know, we had situations, and we were down in the Gulf establishing healthcare programs for children and adults, and which are still operating, by the way. But we found right after the hurricane that kids with cancer, for example, all their medical facilities destroyed in New Orleans. They were ending up being treated in Memphis, Tennessee, and other places in Texas, et cetera. But in a pandemic, every single location would presumably be affected roughly around the same time, so that the ability to move patients around or move resources around will be basically nil. And so every locality will have to depend on its own resources.
Well, Dr. Erwin Redlener, a lot of information. You find yourself asking as you turn the pages, what am I supposed to do with this, you know?
Well, this is, to be honest with you, my wife insisted that I end the book with some real prescription for hope and for optimism here, because the fact of the matter is, yes, it's a dramatic read, this book, Americans at Risk. But at the end of the day, the point I like to make is that virtually all of the problems I discuss are fixable. They are definitely fixable. And there's a prescription in there for what government needs to do and a prescription for what would really help families make themselves more ready. My fantasy was that people would read the book and then send it to their local elected official.
Well, and you talk about, you know, redirecting funds so that there's a national hospital preparedness plan, a national alternative care strategy, helping, first of all, people who don't have insurance, don't have care, developing guidelines for people to take care of themselves and their families. And so let's just talk briefly about that. You know, you talk about everything from stockpiling, you know, water and a crank radio to, as we said, making a plan to getting involved and knowing what your community's doing. Tell us more things that people can do.
Well, some of the things that are not very commonly thought of have to do with this process of getting mentally ready to deal with a disaster or an emergency, which not only applies to mega disasters, but even day-to-day life. For example, I think learning CPR is a very vital skill for virtually everyone to acquire, because first of all, it might help you in an emergency situation save someone's life, day-to-day life. And secondly, if there is a major disaster, being able to be confident in your ability to take care of somebody will generally help your ability to deal with the emergency situations, and that's good. And secondly, The idea of creating these family and community local plans, what would you do? What is your family's particular plan? What phone numbers would you use as common sources of information? And
what's your block's plan? Reunited? Make a block plan.
Exactly. And, you know, figure out who is dependent upon you in your circle of relatives, friends, and neighbors, and who are you dependent on? And getting those things straightened out well in advance of a disaster will really help people function effectively in a disaster and not get panicked or paralyzed
when a dangerous situation arises. I just have to point out one other thing might be to ask your town how they're spending Homeland Security funds. Your list is incredible. I'll just touch on one. Estes Park, Colorado, about 5,000 people there, spent their $88,000 of DHS money on gyms and personal trainers for volunteer firefighters who we want to be in shape, but still
investigate. Yeah, you know, This is unfortunately symptomatic of the most unbelievable lack of accountability on the part of the federal government. You know, they say we're safer, but I don't know about that, and we're certainly not prepared, so we have a lot of work to do.
Dr. Erwin Redlener, director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University, president of Children's Health Fund, and his new book, Americans at Risk. It's a scary read, but perhaps a necessary one. Dr. Redlener, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K to 12 nationwide, mos.org/nctl. And Pegasystems, offering smart business process management software, driving business agility for growth, productivity, and compliance.
The Pakistani Security Service has close ties with the Taliban.
We've tried to time the disclosure through General Ralston, so that any warning would be too late.
ABC says the account was a fictionalized account based in part on the 9/11 Commission report, where Michael Scheuer was the real-life CIA analyst who led the hunt for bin Laden at that time. He's now a terrorism analyst for CBS News. We've brought him in. And, Michael, the arrival of 9/11 is making many Americans uneasy. How about you?
Yeah, I think we're further behind than we were on 9/11 because we haven't done some of the most basic things to protect America, such as controlling our borders. And also a very worrisome deal is a failure of this administration and the Clinton administration to complete the process of securing the Soviet nuclear arsenal. So we haven't negated the possibility of al-Qaeda acquiring its nuclear device from the former Soviet Union.
Well, further behind than the original 9/11, that's a disturbing thought. So let's start talking about some of the things that are in the news. First of all, the ABC docudrama, loosely based on the 9/11 Commission report. Members of the Clinton administration, including then-National Security Advisor Sandy Berger, Madeleine Albright, crying foul, saying they're unfairly portrayed as stonewalling the pursuit of bin Laden. Did they stonewall attempts to get bin Laden?
I don't know if I would call it stonewalling. I just thought I saw from my perspective, and I had a pretty good view into things, a lot of moral cowardice in the sense that protecting Americans didn't come first for that particular administration. And I think no administration. But they clearly had two chances to try to capture Osama bin Laden and eight chances to try to kill him using the U.S. military. And they found excuses for not doing it every time.
The reasoning that was given was that it would have been illegal, that assassination would have been illegal.
Of course, we weren't the United States did not authorize the Central Intelligence Agency to assassinate bin Laden. Our plans were to capture him. And he may have gotten killed in the process, but that was not the intent of the operation. But it's not assassination. When the U.S. military's power is applied against an entity that had declared war publicly on the United States.
Well, what about John O'Neill? He was the then FBI counterterrorism chief who ironically left the FBI and went to the World Trade Towers as head of security and was killed on 9/11. You write in the Washington Times op-ed that he also balked at plans to capture bin Laden and take him, bin Laden, to a third country for incarceration. But what was your exchange then?
Well, basically, he said, why should the FBI help the CIA do anything regarding bin Laden if we don't get credit for doing it? They wanted to bring him here to the United States. And John O'Neill, it's always easy in death to make a hagiography of an individual, but I've never seen an individual, I never knew an individual in the government who deserved less credit.
That's a pretty harsh statement, as is, you know, accusing the Clinton administration of moral cowardice. And by the way, we should rush to say you were equally critical of the Bush administration. You say the war in Iraq, for instance, has broken the back of counterterrorism. You know, just I want to take a second about you, because
yes.
You bring so much opinion to this. Why?
Simply because I watched it. You know, I never, when I was in the government for 22 years, it never occurred to me that my job was anything else than protecting the people of the United States. And if we did that and it brought credit to the Central Intelligence Agency, which I love as an institution, that's fine. But the bottom line was career, promotion, medals never came first for most of the people that work in the U.S. intelligence community. When you go over the list of people that are now heroes these days, be they John O'Neill or Richard Clark, it was never apparent to me that protecting Americans was the first priority to them. They were always afraid of what the Europeans would think if we did something. When we had a chance to kill bin Laden in Afghanistan, they were afraid that we would squirrel a deal for $8 billion worth of F-16s we were selling to the United Arab Emirates. I bring the opinion to the table because I'm foolish enough or naive enough to think that politicians are elected to protect Americans first, foremost, and always. And if you have to take a risk to do that, that's what you get paid for.
How would you characterize the Bush administration's protection of Americans?
Oh, I think it's been pretty much abysmal. The invasion of Iraq was a backbreaking event for United States counterterrorism programs.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what it did was validate for the Islamic world almost all of the rhetoric that bin Laden and his lieutenants had issued over the past 10 years. They said the Americans will destroy any strong Muslim government. They said the Americans will destroy any threat to Israel. They said the Americans will try to occupy places where there are large oil reserves. They said that the Americans will try to destroy our sanctities. And, of course, Iraq is the second holiest place in Islam. So what we did was clearly validate that rhetoric. But more important, the invasion of Iraq satisfies the definition in the Quran and in Islamic theology for the definition of what requires a jihad. It was an unprovoked war, an invasion and an occupation of an Islamic country by an infidel power, if you will. So you take all of those things together and you've really created a worldwide problem that of much greater dimension than the problem we faced against al-Qaeda on 9/11.
Michael Scheuer, why hasn't the U.S. captured Osama bin Laden, and where do you think he is?
Well, I think he's in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Along the border, probably north of a place called Jalalabad, which is near the border.
That's where he's been, though. I mean, we've been hearing that for 5 years. So is it that mountainous? Is it that difficult a region? Is it that impenetrable?
Well, I think the answer is yes. And I think the administration has done itself a great disservice by not showing the American people on television what the topography of that area looks like. But I think more important than that is the fact that we don't have an awful lot of resources devoted to trying to capture or kill Osama bin Laden. By the middle of 2002, we were withdrawing people from Afghanistan to prepare to go to Iraq. We have people working there trying to capture him. But the fact that he lives among tribes that value protecting their guests, even to the extent of risking their lives to do so. The one thing we don't like to admit ever is that Osama bin Laden is the hero, the leader in the Islamic world today. It's very unlikely that anyone is going to turn him over to the United States. And finally, we have depended on the Pakistanis to do our dirty work for us. We continue to operate in kind of the Cold War mindset of having proxies. And we've depended on the Pakistanis, and they're not going to do the job. It's simply not in their interest to do it.
Michael Scheuer, former chief of the bin Laden unit at the CIA from 1996 to 99, also the formerly anonymous author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, and Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Osama bin Laden, Radical Islam, and the Future of America. Michael, we'd love to have you back next week to take a look ahead at what you think is in the future in the war on terrorism. Would you do that for us?
I'd be delighted.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Yes.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, time now to take a break from the serious news of the day to spend a few minutes in the world of sports with Only a Game host Bill Littlefield, who I'm sure objects to
not
that.
Not serious?
Characterization.
Are you mad?
Well, it was certainly serious this weekend. I mean, it would seem as if it was just apocalyptic when Andre Agassi left the game of tennis and to the U.S. Open Tennis Tournament first. A lot of rain, you know, kind of messing with the schedule, but really, some good tennis to watch. And a big match tonight, men's quarterfinals, Roger Federer versus James Blake.
Yes, they're apparently going to play that match, despite the fact that on the other side of the draw, Rafael Nadal got knocked out, which means we won't get to see Nadal play Federer in the final, and that's the only final that makes any sense, because Nadal's the only guy who ever beats Federer. So
that was a big surprise, huh?
Yes, it was.
That he got knocked out. Well, so now onward without him. The women's singles, American Lindsay Davenport out. And this also might be the end of her tennis.
She's been saying for a couple of years that she's considering retiring. She's had a lot of injuries and has come back successfully from the injuries, but with the kind of perspective that comes with somebody recognizing that it won't go on forever. However, after she lost to Annine Hardin, she also said, I think I could have beaten almost anybody else today. So, you know, you take your choice on that one. I don't know what she's going to do.
Yeah, bad feeling. Given that she's out, though, how does the rest of the tournament shape up?
Amélie Mauresmo is the number one player. I would imagine she would still be the favorite to win it all. She plays Maria Sharapova tonight.
Who seemed to give her props last night.
Yes, indeed, yeah. and who's been playing very well herself. So we'll watch the grunters and see what happens.
I just want to ask about that. I mean, you know, she's the one who has... She's Oh, gosh, the noise if
I
you watched last night.
I couldn't play against somebody like that. I would just drop my racket and walk off. I don't know how they do it.
She would scare you away with the grunts on every serve and every hit. But, you know, she's someone who has all these endorsements. We talked about the I Feel Pretty ad. She's got this beautiful outfit that she wears. She is steely out there.
Quite a force. There's no question. She's a very good player, besides all the other, what they used to call image in the Andre Agassi days.
Right. Staying with women, the WNBA Finals, the fifth and deciding game Saturday, the Sacramento Monarchs and the Detroit Shock. Tied 2 games apiece.
Yeah, the remarkable thing about that series, Robin, is that only one of the 4 games has been as close as 10 points. The other, one team or the other, has blown the other one out. And Bill Laimbeer had one of the great coaching quotes of all time coming out of this series. He, of course, is the Detroit coach, and he said, "You have to hate the other team to win a series like this." So the poison of men's sports seeps over into the women's side.
Or the poison of Bill Laimbeer. I'm still, you know,
maybe
Celtics fan back in the day. But staying again with women, track and field star Marion Jones got some good news this week. She was cleared of doping allegations, but it's still tainted? I mean, how does it work?
Well, cleared of this particular doping allegation, the B sample that had been positive at the first test was the B sample was negative, the A sample was positive. She has not been cleared of all the various associations which have raised everybody's eyebrows over the course of some time, ex-husband, ex-trainer, all kinds of other people she's been associated with were associated with Balco. Many of those people have, perhaps to save their own skins, have said Marion Jones has been guilty of using banned substances. So, good honor that she didn't flunk the B side of this particular test, and we'll see what happens next.
Right. Baseball real quick. A no-hitter thrown last night.
Yeah, by a guy who used to be the property of the Red Sox. How come we don't get players like that?
Let's not discuss the Red Sox. We just wish them well. And by the way, just to, you know, we're here in Boston. We do wish them well. So one of the players dealing with a health issue. But back to the no-hitter last night, the Florida Marlins, a rookie pitcher, Anibal Sanchez, as you said, against the Arizona Diamondbacks. He gets a no-hitter. Do you understand the first in the major leagues in more than 2 years?
Yeah, and I was a little surprised to read that was, by these standards, a long period of time. I didn't think no-hitters came along all that often, so I'll have to go back and do some homework on that one.
We impatient American baseball fans.
Right.
And just briefly want to mention, you're going to have something on your program this week on one of the contenders in the wild card race in the American League, the Chicago White Sox.
The Chicago White Sox fighting with the Twins, hoping to get back into the postseason to defend their title. And, yes, we'll be talking to some Sox players on Saturday.
White Sox
players.
Are there other colors besides?
Not this time around.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Always check it out. Hear things you never hear anywhere else. Bill, thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
More ahead here and now.
seek out new life and new civilizations. To boldly go where no man has gone before.
Forty years ago tomorrow, Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek made its television debut. It lasted only three seasons, but has become a cult classic, spawning 10 movies with an 11th in the works, at least five more television series, including Star Trek The Next Generation and Star Trek Deep Space Nine, reams of books, and now a sale. This October in New York City, Christie's will be holding a three-day auction selling 40 years of Star Trek memorabilia from the archives of CBS Paramount Television Studios. Exhibitions of some of the items have been touring the country at a stop at the Mohegan Sun Casino in Uncasville, Connecticut. We asked some of the people there why, after all these years, Star Trek still appeals.
I grew up with it. I was about 6 or 7 years old, and I used to beg my mother to let me stay up till 9:30 and catch the shows, and I grew up with it.
Well, I like the possibility of a better future, like no war, no poverty, no sickness, and it's just, you know, being optimistic and having faith, you know.
I think it has very interesting moral and philosophical issues woven into the stories, and also there's a great richness in its universe and a lot of appealing characters to follow.
It's the imagination. As you can see, the props aren't, like, that great, but the story behind it, you know, made it great.
Here now is Emiko Tamagawa, a self-confessed Star Trek geek, visited the show with Kathy Elkies from Christie's. Kathy has her own memories of watching Star Trek.
I grew up on the original series. We had five channels back then, so you inevitably watched it. And I wasn't old enough to understand sort of the philosophical underpinnings of it and the beliefs that, you know, Gene Roddenberry sort of imbued on the show. But just the effects and the technology, which today is like, you know, yeah, a flip phone, that's cool. But then was just so visionary.
I noticed that over here we have what looks like the captain's chair from the first Star Trek. Am I correct?
Yeah, this is it's a replica of the original series captain's chair that Kirk sat in. It's great. You know, I think there are certain pieces that you look at and they are so sort of visceral. I mean, you know what that chair is. You know who sat in that chair. You know what he did in that chair. You kind of hear the music. You get the whole sort of mood going. And the captain's chair certainly is something that is so easily recognizable, so familiar to anyone that's watched any Star Trek at any point.
Force field of some kind.
And we're coming up on it fast.
Sensor beam on.
Sensor beam on, sir.
Deflectors, full intensity.
Deflectors, full intensity.
Deflectors say there's something there. Sensors say there isn't. Density negative. Radiation negative. Energy negative.
Whatever it is, contact in 12 seconds.
Do you have a favorite character from Star Trek?
I have to say, I always really liked Uhura. I always thought she was really terrific. And we're selling a necklace that she wore that I have to admit, like, at quiet times I've had to try on because it is just so fabulous. And it's this big, sort of ornate necklace. She always had a lot of style, and she had that little thing coming out of her ear, which was kind of fun.
Kirk here.
Captain, I'm picking up a subspace distress call. Priority channel. It's from Space Station K7.
Go to Old Factor 6.
It's called one emergency. That's a disaster call.
This is a red alert. Man your battle station. All hands.
We actually have a nice collection of makeup and prosthetics. So we have, they're not here at Mohegan Sun, but we do have a collection of Vulcan ears. Super recognizable. Everyone knows what they are. We're selling a few pairs of those and some Borg heads and things like that. That I think the makeup is very, you know, it's very tactile. It's quite interesting to look at.
Why now? I mean, obviously it's the 40th anniversary, but is there a particular reason why this auction is happening now?
From a practical perspective, Paramount has had a lot of this material in warehouses for years and years. There's obviously a cost to doing that. Even with a new project in the pipeline, the technology has changed, so things like models actually have become an obsolete craftsmanship, an obsolete art form at this point. So they're sitting in warehouses, and I think given that it is the 40th anniversary and you now have generations of fans that are at a point of their lives and their careers where they can actually collect artifacts and it actually means something to them, the sort of interesting thing about Star Trek is it's multi-generational. generational. You have, you know, people that in the 60s watched original series, and then you have a whole other group that came up in the 80s on Next Generation. Very split camp, very different clients, very different kind of fan base. But it really creates a really wide stretch of people that actually love the show and love the movies. So now that they're sort of at a stage of their life and they have the means, you know, collecting these kind of artifacts is really important to them. And it's, I mean, it's not just a great story, but there's some cool stuff.
Oh, what is it? Is it alive? May I hold it? Oh, it's adorable. What is it?
What is it? Why, lovely lady, it's a tribble.
A tribble?
Only the sweetest creature known to man. Except, and of course, your lovely self.
Oh, it's purring. Listen, it's purring.
It's only saying that it likes you.
Are you selling them?
We have two tribbles in the sale. One of the most popular objects, probably.
Just to remind people, The Trouble with the Tribbles, it's a classic Star Trek episode, and I think they brought it back in Deep Space Nine. It was the little creatures that kept breeding all the time.
Exactly, and these are actually from Deep Space Nine Trials and Tribulations, which was sort of the second reincarnation of the Tribble. And we have two of them in for $800 to $1,200, and you know, I think that's something that will appeal to a broad range of people. I mean, they're just adorable.
Isn't it amazing, though, to think that, you know, this was something that was a prop, and now it's $800 to $1,200, and I think, you know, people have a very strong connection, and they'll probably want to pay that.
I think, again, it's all about sort of this deep connection from childhood or through your parents. I've been going to the Star Trek conventions, and I can't tell you the number of families that come in dressed from, I mean, infants to, you know, small kids to teenagers, right through to the parents, and they're all in their Star Trek garb, and it's terrific. I mean, it's like a whole sort of family thing.
And I was noticing that some of the things in the catalog, you know, go from a couple of hundred, you know, just many thousands or at least several thousands. So can you give us an idea of what the pricing is?
We were very conscious to put together a sale that starts at a couple hundred dollars for some smaller items to tens of thousands of dollars for some of the models. We have a recreation bridge set. I mean, we have a couple of really strong pieces that are, you know, in the $20,000 range. But for the most part, the bulk of the sale really falls somewhere under $1,000. And, I mean, they are obviously pre-sale estimates, but we wanted to really represent all price ranges within the context of the auction.
And I guess it has to be said, what would you say to the skeptics who go, my gosh, this is a TV show. This is a bunch of props. Who cares? Why spend this amount of money on it?
I think it's a really important part of American pop culture. I mean, there's very few things out there that spanned multi-generations and multi-decades and are still so active. I mean, you turn on the channel somewhere in some part of the world, there is a Star Trek airing at that moment. And the fact that people still come to these shows and dress up and are so, and that really it's a community that is so active, tells you it still really resonates and it still means a lot to a lot of people. Having an artifact from it, I think, is a great opportunity.
That's Kathy Elkies, Director of Special Collections at Christie's Auction House in New York. For more information on 40 Years of Star Trek, The Collection, go to our website, beer-now.org. I feel like flying. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll hear about the health problems of first responders at Ground Zero. Also, Claire Massoud's new novel is getting rave reviews for her depiction of elite New Yorkers just before 9/11. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, Here and Now.